It's a great pleasure and privilege to have a chance to talk to Ken Edwards, who I knew as a name and a signature for many years in the old schools, but now is a chance to find out about your life, Ken. I always start by asking when and where you were born.
I was born in Shropshire. My parents ran a small farm, and they were tenants on a big estate. I've often thought since that it's interesting that I wasn't a few miles away, which my parents might have been a tenant on the Swinnerton Dyer estate, which was south of us, but I escaped that and eventually became, as it were, a client of Peter much later in life.
When were you born? When were you born?
1934. I went to the local school, I went to the local grammar school, which for me was a huge opportunity and a great delight, and gave me a chance to find out about things that I wouldn't otherwise. My parents both had left school at 14.
What did they do? What did your parents do?
They were all from farming families in South Shropshire and moved what seemed to the family a great distance away, all of 30 miles to North Shropshire to set up a small farm they ran, which, being an only child, I helped on a great deal when I was young. I went to the local grammar school.
What was that? Which grammar school was that?
In Market Drayton, which is a small town right up in the northeast of Shropshire. Only about 350 students, not very specialised, but for me it was tremendous, and I got interested in science, and I decided that what I wanted to do was to be a scientist. But because of my rural background, because of my parents were in farming, I was keen to combine science with agriculture. So that took me to Reading University.
You're going too fast.
Sorry. Okay.
Can we go back a bit?
Yeah.
Do you know anything about your grandparents?
My grandparents, all came from farming families on the edge of the Long Mynd. They were, I've been looking up the census dates. My grandfather was described as a labourer on a farm. So I suppose the fact that my father actually became a farmer was quite a bit of social mobility, I would. They lived all of 7 miles apart, although my father used to walk 7 miles every Sunday to court my mother, in the jargon of the time, and 7 miles back again across an open moorside. And he did that for 13 years before they got married.
13?
13.
Gosh.
And the reason was, I gather, that it was not the custom to get married until you got a home to take a bride to. And he was a farm manager without a house to live in, and still living at home with his parents, or living in the farmer's house. But until he got the tenancy of the farm himself, they didn't get married. So he was 39 or 40, 39 when they got married, 40 when I was born. I think the shock was so much they decided not to have any more children, so I spent my rather lonely childhood in this on this farm.
And tell me something about the character of your parents. I mean, the way it might have influenced you. You're a geneticist, so this
yes,
is all
indeed. there were not many books in the house, so the school library when I got to my sort of 15, 16, so it was a great source of delight for me, and I read pretty avidly at that stage. My father was a slightly taciturn man. They had the kind of relationship that I think was probably fairly typical in those communities, where the man was very much the dominant figure in the house and made most of the decisions. I used to think that my mother was rather weak in not standing up for herself, and I used to say to her sometimes when I was in my teens, why don't you decide what to do? And she always passed that off. But in the end I decided that she was probably the stronger character. In fact, when they became very old, my father became really quite morose as an old man. Well, when he died when he was 81. She was much tougher, so I think they were very supportive of me. They obviously had high ambitions for me. And they didn't understand what a university was, but they were very keen that I should go to one.
Right. Well, do you remember your first school at all? I mean, the one before the grammar school.
Yes, my first school was in the days before the 44 Education Act.
Hmm.
So it was, in fact, a small private prep school, which I used to. My father used to take me on his bike on his on the seat on the crossbar of his bike, but 2 miles or so to this school, and I went there, and then it became through a process that I never knew about and didn't understand now, sort of somehow incorporated into what became the grammar school under the 44 Education Act. And so I just moved seamlessly from this small primary school to the secondary school and stayed there till I was 18.
And you mentioned being, having a rather lonely childhood. Did this take you out into the fields looking at nature and things like that?
Yes, it did. Never became really focused on any particular aspect of naturalism, of naturalist studies, but I did wander about the fields a lot. And in fact, through school, which was only 2 miles away, the nearest town was only a couple of miles away. Since I started going to school, I got lots of friends who lived in the town and used to, and my social circle was in fact through the school. And there was one other farm on about half a mile away, which they had one child who I used to see quite a bit of. But I spent a lot of time on my own.
You didn't collect birds?
I didn't collect, no.
Eggs or anything?
No. I used to, the only collection I did was collecting the hen's eggs from the farm and it was one of my chores.
And you didn't have microscopes or anything?
No, I didn't. No.
When you went to the grammar school, you said it encouraged you. Were there any teachers there who especially influenced you, remember?
Yes, I do. There was a classics teacher who I admired a great deal and who encouraged me to read more widely than my silly subject-based reading was taking me, particularly when I got into the sixth form. A pretty eclectic mix of things that I would read.
Do you remember his name?
Yes, his name was John, Mr. John. He was a Welshman. He went off to be a headmaster somewhere, but this was 50 years ago. The biology teacher, I remember, was particularly enthused me about biology, and she actually taught both botany and zoology, so in the sixth form, and so I did both those subjects and chemistry and physics as well. I think it was the atmosphere of the school was a fairly small sixth form, but we were quite a tightly knit group and stimulated each other in our interest in our reading and talking about current affairs and listening to music and all the things that, in fact, I think I benefited from being in that particular school. It didn't have great academic traditions, it was too small for that.
Do you have the Welsh musical tradition, I mean singing and things like this? Or?
No, it didn't. We were, interestingly, my parents, Edwards is a Welsh name,
yes.
It was a border country name.
Mm.
My mother was a Lewis. Both lived within 10 miles of the Welsh border, but the whole thing felt very English on that side of the border. And we didn't have that great. I like to think that my ancestors were probably had a somewhat disreputable past. It probably involved sheep crossing across the Welsh-English border, but I haven't been able to find that out.
And what about games and sports and things like that? Were you good at those, interested in those?
No, not as good as I'd like to be. I played hockey and played cricket, but my cricket was more because I loved the game and not because I was good at it. Again, it was too small a school to run a rugby team. So one of my great regrets is that I play rugby. We could get 11 lads together to play football, but not 15 to play rugby.
What about music? You mentioned music in passing, but has music meant a lot to you later on?
It has, yes. I bitterly regret, that's too strong a term. I do regret that I never learned to play an instrument. But I now spend a lot of my time listening to music. Again, through friends at school who Grammar fans and used to go and listen to the music with them. I soon developed a sort of very set taste, and I remember saying at one stage, and I'm rather ashamed of this now, anything written after Beethoven was rubbish, which I don't believe now, but it was that kind of enthusiasm for music which was channeled in particular ways and which gave me a feeling that certain things were okay and other things were not okay. That sort of judgmental phase of what was right and what was interesting and what was not. What else did I do at school? A little bit of acting, but not
very
much.
Yes, I was going to ask. Drama, politics, no politics.
Yes, we used to talk about politics a lot. And, this was in the time immediately in the sixth form, which was in the early 1952. French had the post-war Labour government. And at that time my parents were conservative and I was, I suppose, drifted in that direction. But we had quite vigorous arguments and I gradually became just sort of feel less sure about the rightness of the right, if you see what I mean. I have very happy memories of school days. And I'm really grateful for the grammar school. I must say that I do regret the passing of the grammar school because it gave people like me a chance to achieve things that otherwise I probably wouldn't have been able to.
Well, some of those Welsh border grammar schools are very good. I mean, Barry Grammar School.
Yeah.
My supervisor was at Keith Thomas and Habakkuk, another famous historians were at. It was obviously a very good grammar school. Were you beginning to specialise in science at this point, or?
No, I was doing fairly broad my A-levels, although it was actually in the day before A-levels, but I took high school certificates in physics, chemistry and two biologies, and I did some maths as well, but not in A-levels. But I decided that the thing that I was interested in particularly was combining science with agriculture. And that what I wanted to do, the most attractive combination that I could find, was agriculture and botany. I didn't come to Cambridge, but I got in the North. I don't know, because I never tried, because you couldn't actually run that combination. You could do agriculture here, or you could do natural sciences. And so I went to Reading, which you could do that combination. But before that, I'd done 2 years national service. Which I have to say for me, although a lot of the time it seemed very boring, was probably very good for me. I think I got a lot more out of being a university student 2 years later, because I'd had this rather narrow experience of life before that, and I had to rub shoulders with all sorts of people from different backgrounds. I think it was probably good for me. Somewhat frustrating, because the RAF was training national servicemen to be pilots. And I thought that would be great fun. So I applied for that, but failed my medical for aircrew training. Because I then got some science, so I put onto a wireless, as it was called then, of course. After that, volunteered for an overseas posting and got sent to Northern Ireland, which I thought was for about 6 months, but then eventually posted back to within 3 miles of my home. So I didn't see the world as much as I'd hoped to. In those 2 years of national service.
But it was boring, but soul enhancing, so to speak.
Yes, I think socially it rubbed a lot of corners off me, I think, probably. And so I felt when I got to university, at 20 rather than 18, able to feel more confident about being able to mix with people. And I think probably got more satisfaction, more enjoyment out of my university years than I would have done had I gone at 18. In my case, I think that's probably true.
So what was Reading like? Was it enjoyable or interesting?
Reading was a very small university, very high proportion.
Very famous for its agricultural studies.
Agriculture faculty accounted for a third of the students. One of the remarkable things about it, for a male student, which was a good thing, but roughly equal numbers of men and women.
Gosh, that stage, it's unusual.
In the 1950s. And in fact, quite a lot of 50th wedding anniversary last summer, and we had several couples who we had known as couples in Reading, who are still together, so it's been quite effective. I got enthusiastic about rowing, I got enthusiastic about getting involved in student politics and student affairs and the student union. And probably didn't work as hard as I might have done the first few years. Until one day the head of the department, where I was doing my final year, said, I think you need to decide whether you're going to give up rowing or go for a good degree. And he said, in the long term, I would recommend the latter. So I took his advice. And
you took his advice?
I took his advice. And
were there any, either he or other teachers, who you remember as being good lecturers or inspiring you at that time?
I remember him particularly. He was an interesting man. He's a South African who had been, amongst other things, the technical research director on the Grandma scheme in Tanzania. And a lot of experience in the tropics. And
what was his name?
Hugh Bunting. And he became Professor of Agriculture and Botany at Reading. And I think he enthused me. He enthused me in general about the subject, not particularly about tropical botany. But I think his sort of sense of challenge that he had and his liveliness was something that I responded to positively and enjoyed very much. There were some very competent lecturers there who I felt were doing a very good job, even if they weren't necessarily charismatic or exciting. And after all, how many university lecturers are charismatic and exciting? You hope they're competent, and most of them are.
So towards the end, you had a choice between rowing and your good degree, but were you beginning to think of what you would do afterwards?
Yes, I was fairly clear that I wanted to do a PhD, and I wanted to work in full-time research. My choice of specialty in botany, I discovered, was actually became overwhelmed by my not increasing knowledge of genetics. And in some ways, genetics was easier. And the way it was easy, you didn't have to learn as many facts. Once you knew the rules of the game, you'd go on applying them. And the ingenuity of applying them was something that I found attractive and something I could do. And so it became clear by my final year that what I wanted to do was research in genetics. Because of the nature of the degree, one obvious way in which this might be done would be in plant breeding. And indeed, that was my next step.
Was this a period, I mean, looking backwards, we imagine it was a very, very exciting period in genetics because of the work of Crick and Watson and others in the 50s and the early 60s. Did it feel like that then?
Not for the kind of genetics I was doing, which was still classical Mendelian-based genetics. It was clear that the discovery of the nature of DNA would in the long term have tremendous effects on the way in which genetics was studied. But it wasn't clear at that time how that was going to be done technically, what kind of experiments would be available to give you more information you could get from the sort of Mendelian type analysis of looking at ratios and numbers and the frequency with which particular appearances came up. It was a sort of feeling that, yes, okay, this is very exciting. This is really establishing the basic material of life. We don't know what its structure is. And then, of course, shortly after, was the realization that not only did it give you the self-replicating material which you needed for inheritance, that something could be copied, but actually the sequence of DNA also gave you the code, which would the way the information was written, it would be understood. That was very exciting, but it wasn't all clear at that stage how the technology of doing experiments would have an impact, that would arise from this, would have an impact on the kind of genetics I was doing at that stage.
Mm-hmm. Was the work of Bateson, William Bateson of Cambridge, influential?
Yes, that works. He was one of the great figures of that period, and the rediscovery of Mendelism and the development of that. The aspects that I think probably the biggest impact on me was the, which was still active in that in the 1950s, was the development of quantitative techniques to understand more complicated genetics and the population genetics.
Yes, Anthony Edwards, Fisher.
And J.B.S. Haldane and Saul Wright. And what I was doing was trying to study the genetics of fairly complex characters, which didn't operate through single Mendelian ratios because they're probably controlled by many genes rather than just a few. And the quantitative methods that it seemed actually a million miles away from the likely consequences of what Watson and Crick had discovered before they would have much impact on how you would do that kind of quantitative learning. And in fact, it's taken really best part of 50 years for that to have a major impact, as it is now doing.
Did you have to be a good mathematician to do this kind of work?
No, we had to. Had to be a reasonably good statistician,
Which you are.
Which I was. I've probably forgotten those now, but seeing the glimmer of what statistics as applied to experimental biological experiments could achieve was really quite an eye-opener, I remember. And again, Fisher was one of the great contributors to this, and the design of experiments was certainly made me realise what it was all about, to understand it.
This was just the period when computers were beginning to become more powerful and common. Was this beginning to influence anything?
Not until sometime later, when I went to Aberystwyth to do a PhD, the research institute actually attached to the university, working for what was then the Agricultural Research Council. Now the BBSRC, Biological Science, Biochemistry and Biological Sciences Research Council. And most of the statistics was done on electric calculators, which is extremely laborious. But then, I did a PhD and then I went to the States for a year.
And what was the theme of the PhD?
The theme of the PhD was actually dealing with the inheritance of certain leaf growth characters in perennial ryegrass. And it was aimed to try and find out whether you could use fairly simple measures of growth which would allow you to make selections to improve yield and whether that would be carried through rather than looking having to grow the whole plant and looking at yield in a complicated way to look at aspects of development of leaf growth. And that went quite well actually. But I must say, I think back now to some research students I've known who've had to come in and pick up from scratch and start to develop their material. I had the benefit of moving into a research institute where there was lots of material and lots of technical advice on what I was doing. So what you lost was the general feeling of excitement about being in university, because the research institute was very focused. What you gained was the benefits of that higher focus, and that everybody around was working in similar areas.
Who was your supervisor?
The supervisor was a chap called John Cooper, who eventually was elected to the Royal Society. But a great enthusiast, somewhat accident prone. I remember one day he came in with his arm in a sling. I said, "What have you done, John?" He said, "Well, cracked a rib." So how do you do that? Well, I was rushing from one room to another, opened the door, but not quite far enough, and ran into the door. And that actually summed up John. But you were careful about letting him get involved in your actual technical experimentation.
He might break it all.
He might break it all.
At the end of that, you got your PhD, and then you decided to go to America.
Yes.
Why?
Why? Because I sort of wanted to broaden my experience, and I've been following. I'd actually got, from dealing in quantitative genetics, as they're called, the genetics of complex characters, does involve quite a bit of statistics. Nothing very elaborate, but quite detailed. I felt I wanted to move into the area of population studies rather than and I didn't have much background in that, and this is where my reading of Fisher and Denby Assault and so on had stimulated those thoughts. So I went to a group in Davis, University of California at Davis, which again had, but that time, a largely agriculturally based university, with the original land grant college for the state of California. Again, fairly small university at that time, about 4,000 or 5,000 students. They were 31,000, I think, for Moscow. But there's one particular guy that I had read his work and wanted to go and work with. And that's how I learned quite a lot of population genetics in that case. And it was a great experience too. It was a time of the short presidency of JFK, and as there he'd been elected the previous January, 1960, 1961, so the year and a half prior to my arrival. There was an area of some excitement still, feeling a great contrast with the rather gentle and inspiring careers of Eisenhower. At least this was in the academic community, and of course this is. Most of the Americans I know seem to be Democrats, which is perhaps not surprising in the academic community. And I remember going to see Kennedy speaking in the Berkeley football stadium to a huge crowd, and when he appeared, this tiny figure from where I was sitting in the stands on the stage, there was an air of real excitement about, a real buzz about him. And then we talked a lot about politics and the politics of change in America. The guy I worked with thought we were in Britain a sort of rigidly socialist state, and we used to have arguments about what he calls socialised medicine. And I was trying to defend the NHS. But it was a human. So that was quite, that was for a year. I think.
It was before the Cuba Missile Crisis.
Before the Cuba Missile, that happened just after we left there.
Yeah. Were you married by this time?
Or? Yes. Yeah.
So Janet came with you?
Janet came with me. She was a qualified school teacher, but she couldn't, her qualifications didn't hold in California, so she couldn't get a teaching job. So she worked in a bank, in Wells Fargo, which was
the bank.
Sounds quite romantic. And for the first time we had enough money. We'd been married during the time of my PhD, my first teacher, but very little money. But going to the States, and I was on a postdoc fellowship, the princely sum was $6,000. And Janet was working. We felt if we wanted to go out and have a meal, we'd go out and have a meal. And we travelled quite a lot up and down the West Coast and into Canada. And that was in fact a very rewarding. I came back feeling full of admiration for the United States. Lots of things, lots of aspects of policy in recent years that have been very irritating. But basically, I admire the place. We went back some years later to Davis at the time that the Nixon presidency was in crisis. And it was during the Watergate hearings, the Senate Committee. And I used to watch these regularly, and it was really like watching an onion being peeled. You know. The presentation was of something sort of untouchable. And then gradually under questioning, the exposed layer, which would be some fairly junior official in the Nixon administration, would start to make admissions. And obviously there was behind the scenes a lot of plea bargaining going on. And that layer would come off and expose the next layer and so on. And I remember feeling that it was quite impressive that the structure and the constitution was robust enough to have that degree of public exposure of wrongdoing without a threat to the system. Eventually Nixon did resign. But I remember being very impressed with this, with the American US constitution and the way it operates. And sometimes really that our constitution rests so much on on goodwill, and the expectation that things won't go badly wrong. But it's not as robust as the US Constitution. So, and I just go, every time I go there, I feel a real sort of buzz of excitement about the place.
You never thought of settling down there?
I did during that first year, and we had an opportunity to stay another year, and then perhaps another year after that, and nothing might have evolved. But I think we both realised my parents are still alive. I'm an only child. They'd never travelled very much. They would have missed grandchildren. Donna's very close to her family and didn't want to be that far away. So we felt that we had to come back after 1 year, otherwise we might never have made it back. I came back to a job in the Research Institute at Aberystwyth, where I'd done my PhD and worked there for another 3 years.
Had you had children by this time? Or
we had the first child within sort of 6 or 8 months of coming back from the States. And I remember it very well. It's my daughter's birthday today, actually.
Is it?
Oh. And she was born in a snowstorm 46 years ago now. And Aberystwyth doesn't get snowstorms very often. Well, it does, of course. The roads means so many steep inclines. It was actually quite a...
So it was difficult to get to the hospital.
Hair-raising experience getting to the maternity hospital. Yes, that is it.
This is a daughter?
That's our daughter, yeah.
How many children have you got?
Three. Two sons born later, 3 years and then 5 years after Julia. They're all doing very different things. Juliet, I'm rushing ahead a bit, but they all went to school here schools in Cambridge. Juliet is a pianist and making a modest living and playing the piano, but getting a lot of satisfaction from it. The elder boy, Steve, went to work at 18 for what was then Robert Sale, but has been doing a variety of jobs, including being sales and marketing for big firms, been made redundant a couple of times, and then sort of running his own small business. And the youngest, Tony, is the one who's gone into academic life. He did economics, and he's now a reader at King's College London. So they're all doing very different things.
Did having children make you rethink about genetics?
Yes, the sort of joke in the family that all the three of them have got the Edwards nose. Knowing a little bit about the subject, not being a medical genetics, but knowing a little bit about the subject, there was always some concern in the back of my mind during each of Jenna's pregnancies as to whether they would be born with any afflictions of any sort. And a great relief to sort of realise that when you see them, they look pretty normal. So the first child was born when we came back to Aberystwyth, and we stayed there for a couple of years, and then actually this was working full-time research, continuing the kind of work I'd been doing beforehand. And then, must have been 1966, I think, I got a chance to go on secondment for 6 months to teach in the University of Birmingham Genetics Department. Because somebody there whom I'd worked with had been on sabbatical leave in the States. And I agreed that, and we got it arranged that I would go there and do his teaching for the autumn and spring term. And did that, and really enjoyed teaching. And that's when I decided that I was looking around at the people in the Research Institute, and it was rather closely focused environment, and rather sort of introverted. I could see people 20 years older than me doing basically the same experiments they'd been doing 20 years earlier, with variations on this or that level, but not with basically lots of new ideas. And partly because it was a focused both in the kind of work and focused in its ambitions, that it was actually trying to breed new varieties of crops, that the sort of pressure to achieve certain definable aims was quite strong. done that, I started looking around for jobs.
What was it about teaching that you liked? And was it
the contact with the students, the chance to sort of get ideas back from students, even if it's sometimes only in the kind of questions that made you think, yes, not sure about that myself, actually. And that goes, there's a bit about me that likes standing in front of a class and feeling I'm hopefully telling them something, but I'm hopefully also bringing something in the development of the intellect. That looks kind of rather grand and pompous, doesn't it? But,
so you enjoyed the lecturing. Did you have any kind of supervision system?
Yes, yes. And that in some ways was more rewarding.
Hmm.
And running practical classes as well is a different kind of experience, because it's somewhere between the two in the sense that it's more one-to-one, less didactic and more personal. So I did that for 6 months, and then I decided that that's really what I wanted to do. So I applied for jobs, in fact. And that summer, after being in Birmingham, there was a post-lectureship in genetics in the Old School of Agriculture here, which I applied for. But in between my application going in and the interview being held, I was phoned by John Soley, who was a professor of genetics in the genetics department there, who no doubt knew, and said he's about to advertise a job, which sounded as if it might suit me, would I be interested? And so I came over and saw him, saw the department, and decided that was really the job I wanted to have in genetics rather than... some part of me which said I want to get out of this association with agriculture, because my interests have gone way away from the sort of direct involvement in research which was aimed at improving in some way agriculture or farming or crop growth or crop breeding, and wanted to be much more wide-ranging in my interest. So that was 1966. I came to the Genetics Department. I came with some trepidation, I have to say, because I had done very little teaching except been in Birmingham, and I had really no experience at Cambridge at all, and I thought this was probably a rather strange place. Indeed, I discovered over subsequent years it is a strange place, but not in the way perhaps that I thought it was going to be.
Tell me in what ways, or maybe you want to talk about it later, how it's strange and different.
Yeah, perhaps I can come back to that. Yeah. I'm coloured now by my direct experience and fairly deep level involvement in Cambridge. I think it's strange. I thought it was strange, perhaps strange, and would be rather cool towards somebody who had come in at that sort of level for a lectureship from outside. So it was a kind of trepidation. Would I fit? Would I find it already a kind of sort of well-knit society in which I would not fail to feel like I could join. In fact, the genetics department was not like that at all. And I must say that John Soder, who many people found difficult in some ways, sadly he died a few months ago, but he was extremely helpful to new young lecturers. He offered to come and sit in some of my lectures and make comments in the class, and it was a bit uninspiring, but he did that and extremely helpful. So from that point of view, I felt I settled in very, very quickly.
Were there any other major figures in Cambridge then, or subsequently in the genetics department you wanted to?
There were people now who've become sort of quite famous. I mean, Michael Ashburn, of course, was a bit younger than me. He was already obviously a rising star. There was a man called David Cove who went up to be a professor at Leeds, who was large in every sense, with red hair and red hair.
How do you spell his name?
C-O-V-E.
Cove, yeah.
David Cove, yeah.
Yeah.
There was probably a lot of some bubbling ideas around, and people with A bit isolated then. It was out on the Milton Road, at the old Field Labs, where the vet school had been at one stage, I gather. So we, during the day, we were sort of a bit isolated, which had some disadvantages, but had, you know, the upside was that we actually saw a lot of each other. We used to have lunch together in the local
How did the students get there for lectures and things?
It's only the third year students who came out, so they actually had bicycles on and they came out. And they were there all day as well. The lecturing and teaching was done in the first and second years. We came in for central science. I remember that one of my first tasks was to give some lectures on basic genetics to the agriculture third year, or was it second year agricultural student class. And I was rather amazed to find that the wearing of gowns by the lecturers was still a custom there. But it wasn't in natural sciences. So I got involved in teaching first year courses in both natural sciences and biology of organisms and in agriculture, particularly in the second year as well. So I was fairly frequently coming in and out of it.
Mm. Were you associated or attached to any college at that?
Not at first. Not for the first 3 or 4 years, and then got invited by St John's to a teaching fellowship. Particularly with the responsibility of teaching biology of cells the first year program, supervising in that moment. So I read. Looking back on that period, I think that I found it all, in a rather strange sense, rather unsettling. The unsettling nature was there were so many things that one could do here in Cambridge. And I don't just mean outside the university. I'm not talking about the sort of the cultural life that goes along with the university. I'm talking about the opportunities as a university lecturer. There were lots of people to talk to and lots of ideas. And I suppose, I think now looking back at myself, I didn't perhaps focus as much on research as I should have done. And I think now I describe myself as having something of a butterfly mind. The next topic was always more interesting than the one I was currently engaged in and needed to finish and write up. And so I probably didn't do as much of that conclusion stuff as I wanted. And the other aspect of that was that I got involved in all sorts of other sort of administrative activities. Firstly in the department. John Thurley obviously grew to rely on me as somebody who could actually deliver when given an administrative task. And I'm not sure to this day about academics whether there are many of them innately unable to cope with administrative tasks, or so desperately don't want to do them that they
but learn the art of being inefficient.
Learn the art of being inefficient and of not being asked. So I got quite involved in
What were you, the secretary of the department, or...?
No, but I run the timetable and run the student assessment system and then run the examination system locally and just generally did things that John Sadie asked me to do. Got involved in college life, became secretary to the college council and a tutor. And in fact, I remember, I was thinking about this the other day when John So did memorial service. I remember very clearly the day which actually really changed my life, which was when he took me aside one day and said, Ken, I'm going to take a sabbatical year to write a book. I'd like you to take over as acting head of the department while I'm away. So I said, well, not sure about that because I've just got these two new research grants that will need a lot of attention. I've just become a college tutor, which is going to take a lot of time. So I was about to say, so I'll have to say no. And he said, before you say no, just think of the alternatives. Which of your colleagues would you want to run the department if you're not doing it?
well-known technique,
but when it was applied directly to me, as he told me, and I thought, I think you've got me there, I think I can't actually face that. So I did that for a year. He came back and said that he only got 3 or 4 years to go to retirement. He didn't want to ask him, would I carry on, so I did carry on. And I got involved in the Council of the School of Art, Arts, and Sciences, and I became chairman of that. With doing less and less research, I got to a point when I was thinking, well, when Joan said he retired to get a new head of department, I'll take a year off. I'll go to work in the lab in Canberra, where I had some contacts and had been anyway. And I'll learn all these new techniques that are coming in, the sort of things I've been talking about, and to become a molecular biologist, or at least a sufficient molecular biologist to apply them to the kind of things that are kind of research topics that I was interested in. And so I was beginning to get that organised when the Secretary General's job came up. And John Thode and Ian Nicol was very keen that I should apply. So I did thinking I probably wouldn't get it, but I did, and so that was it. But I think without having taken over the headship of the department, and I wouldn't have done that if I hadn't felt that that was something I didn't want anybody else to do, I would probably not have moved into
this. Can I just ask you, I mean, the connection between the butterfly mind and administration, just as one wonders whether one's colleagues are as inefficient as they make out in order to avoid administration, one wonders with some of my colleagues who are inefficient and who avoid it, then justify their existence by saying, well, actually, the people who go into administration are people who really can't do the research and so on, and they need something to do to give them excuse for not doing research. So there's a counter argument like that.
Sure.
I'm not sure that's true at all, but I mean, did you ever feel that your interest in administration was partly because you were searching for something that would give you a really meaningful life which wasn't research?
There may have been an element, I think, for which perhaps it was, but there were positive sides as well. The butterfly mind, the satisfaction of those impulses that I've described as being butterfly mind, were actually most fully satisfied when I was actually at the level of being a vice chancellor, because I had a good reason for going around departments and asking them what they were doing, and telling them to explain to me what they were doing. And my greatest joy was that sort of schedule of saying, okay, I'd like the biochemistry department to come in and spend half a day with you. I leave it to you to decide how you want to play this. Do you want me to go around different parts of the department or meet the whole department? I'd quite like to meet the whole department at some stage. But for the rest, I'll leave it to you. And it was very interesting because sometimes I'd go in, I learned this question, you go in and you say, okay, I want you to tell me, as a department, what's really interesting in your subject area, what's really exciting you now. And some departments, after that, you couldn't stop them talking. Mm. Other departments would look at one another and say, there's some deep plot here, some being subversive.
He's going to cut out the bits that aren't interesting.
But in fact, I found myself genuinely interested in the kind of things that why the art history department were planning to put on particular courses or what particular aspects of, and then going to biochemistry where I felt a bit more comfortable as far as the knowledge is, and then going to geology. I think. In that sense, I felt that having that range of interest, I'm trying not to sound too self-congratulatory here, but having that butterfly mind, if you like, a real interest in what people were doing, which had to be kind of superficial, okay, but it was actually, an effective tool, part of the whole toolkit of being a vice-chancellor.
And this was at Leicester?
This was at Leicester, yeah. Now, the 3 years of Secretary-General in Cambridge were somewhat different.
What is a Secretary-General? It sounds very military.
I mean, it's a strange job. It was a strange job. It doesn't really exist now. You worked as the Vice-Chancellor, but the Vice-Chancellor at that time was a two-year appointment, and the Vice Chancellor would be doing other things. In my first 2 years, on my first, but the beginning of my Secretary Generalship, John Butterfield was the Vice Chancellor. Now he was Master of Downing and the Regius Professor of Physics, and had lots of other national commitments as well. So the level of the time that he could devote to the detail of the details of running the university were fairly small. Stephen Fleet, who was the registrar, was very good at accepting that the academic matters of the university were matters of the general board and the secretary general, his office, and the vice chancellor. So I had a fairly clear view of the university's academic affairs, and Stephen got on and ran the administration. And John was very supportive, John Butterfield very supportive, but it really hadn't got the time to get involved. So, things that, let me just tell you about the first day in the job.
Sure.
Because the three people who made appointments to see me. There were two people. There's John Taylor, who is a professor in theoretical physics and applied math. There's John Rushbrook, who was a reader in Cavendish. Their concern was at this time British government were so worried about their foreign exchange levels that they were considering putting out of CERN, the annual subscription to CERN. This, these two said, would be a disaster for them, because experimental high-energy particle physics would become impossible almost overnight, because it's so dependent upon the facilities at CERN. Theoretical high-energy particle physics would last a bit longer, but would die in a couple of years. Physics would probably be dead in 10 years, and civilization, we know, is in 20. Well, I'm characterizing the argument somewhat, but that was the first thing. So I said, okay, what are you going to find out? So it's about intermediate vector bosons. So I read up something about intermediate vector, but this is my butterfly mind again. The second visitor was Wynne Godley.
Oh yes, I've interviewed him. Wynne.
Yeah.
Yes.
Now Wynne was then director of the Department of Applied Economics, into which a university review was taking place,
yes.
Has been started by my predecessor. So he felt that he'd like to come and talk to me about the department run, and particularly about the way in which research is done in economics, which I must admit I hadn't thought about very much. And he said basically there are two ways to do it. Either you can do the sort of thing that I and my colleagues do, which is to measure lots and lots of things and look for patterns of association. And the other is to have a theoretical idea about how the economy might work, which allows you to make predictions which you can then test, which is what Frank Hahn does. I mean, I'm again simplifying what he's arguing. And that was the second major interview of the day. The third was Don Cupid, who was then...
I'm going to interview in a week's time.
Who was then chairman of the Faculty Board of Divinity. And he came because there was a personnel problem in the department, in the faculty. And it involved the evidence that they had that one of their staff, in addition to being a full-time member of the faculty, full-time university reader, had a chair in a German university simultaneously. Which eventually I followed up by contacting a German university and finding out indeed it was true. Which led to my inviting this particular individual to come and see me with two pieces of paper, his contract for the University of Cambridge, and a letter from the German university saying, this is not acceptable, is it? I want a letter from you by Friday morning, either saying you've resigned, one or the other. That was the first day, and I thought, oh, this is a fascinating job. never boring. The issues that came up then were the main, I mean, one of the things that really was very dramatic was when Martin Rees came to see me one day, because he was then at the Institute of Astronomy, say that he understood that the Science Research Council then was considering a move of the Royal Greenwich Observatory from Hurston and so in Sussex to a university, and would Cambridge be interested in hosting it? And it was either Cambridge or Manchester, I gather. So my immediate reaction was to say, in principle, obviously yes. I then talked to a number of people in Cavendish and engineering department and so on, and there was, and we talked about site behind the Institute of Astronomy on the Madigan Road. And I remember one January day in the snow, tramping through the orchard there with representatives of the Science Research Council about the site. Then it ran into trouble. And it ran into trouble because this is one of the things that I feel is both great about Cambridge and in fact a hindrance, and that is the existence of Regent House. There were a number of people who objected to the idea of the
Regent House is in effect the governing body.
The governing body, yeah. Mm. And the fact that everything has to go to ballot. Mm. Here was an issue in which all the people about it were enthusiastic. Now we had to do quite a lot of detailed discussions about the practicalities of the move and the terms and conditions in which the move would be made and the finance from the Science Research Council before obviously we could actually say much about what we were actually asking Regent House to approve. So there was a dilemma of how much you discuss this in the, or start a discussion in the very general terms about the principle without knowing, because people say, well, we don't know what we're being asked to make a judgment on. Is how much you wait until you've got some reasonably well worked up scheme to put to them. And I suppose it's an issue which all governments have too about proposals. If you have too much of a general discussion, people say, well, ridiculous with anybody being asked if you've got it worked out too much to say you're trying to make it a cut and dried case. But there were quite a number of people who I felt were making objections on really not very good grounds, such as who will these people be? Will there be proper Cambridge people who can be with these research council staff? It took a long time for that to get resolved. In fact, of course, ultimately it wasn't a success. But at the time, it was, I'm sure, the right thing to do.
It wasn't a success.
Well, eventually it was closed down under a different council commission.
No, I didn't know that.
Yeah. It was because the Research Council had yet another change of major policy about about the way they support astronomy. And astronomy, of course, is fairly done directly in terms of observation terms from Britain. Mm. Most of the big telescopes are international ones on the tops of mountains in the tropics where you can put both north and south and there's not so much pollution in the atmosphere here and so on. And so what the Research Council turned about is now PPAL, the Particle Physics and Astronomy Research Council, is actually providing support facilities and for British astronomers to use the big observatories in somewhere else in the world. But I can remember one discussion with some representatives of the Research Council when we were working out the details, and they said, well, you know, we seem to be near agreement, and when can we get final agreement? I said, well, we've got to get it through the university. Is that going to be difficult? Well, there are a few committees and so on. Will it take 3 months? And I said, a bit longer than that. In fact, it took 2 years, actually. And I remember meeting later, after I moved to Leicester, to a reception somewhere in London, a guy called Bill Mitchell, who'd been chairman of the Research Council at that time, who's an Oxford physicist. And I was introduced to somebody who was talking to was, this is Ken Edwards, this is the man who persuaded me to move the RGO to Cambridge. And I said, Bill, you said as if you regretted that decision. He said, had I realised how long it's going to take Cambridge to make up its mind, I probably would have recommended it to have gone to Manchester, which I thought was a bit rich from somebody who knew the Oxford system, but there are. So that, coming back to the role of Secretary General, it was a fascinating job because you did get involved in all aspects of the university's academic life. too big a canvas to get in, intimately concerned with all of it, obviously, but right across a wide range of subjects. I can remember the time when the French department was proposing to introduce a paper in its second year on French art and literature. I can't remember the exact title, but something like that. And there was great upset from the art history department, which I naively assumed was probably just a territorial dispute about numbers of students who would be attracted to one rather than the other. But in fact it wasn't, it was about postmodernism. And I felt really out of my depth as a scientist on that one. So it's a variety of the job was fascinating. I'm sad to see that the job has gone, because I mean that arrangement was really in the long term, or longer term, or even perhaps in the short term, untenable, because the university clearly needed a full-time vice-chancellor. And the part-time 2-year change rather than being offered. I was representing the university, but I didn't have the status of the prestige of being the vice-chancellor, and the should be. So that kind of change was necessary, which means what's the role of the Secretary General? We've been doing lots of vice-chancellor's tasks. Now it seems to me that the current vice-chancellor, the vice-chancellor in the present world has spent a lot of time being the face of the university outside. And I think, I still say there couldn't be a role for a Secretary General type figure in the American system, provost.
You're saying that in a way the the Secretary General was like a provost at an American university.
I think what I meant was that it could have become like a provost, with the vice-chancellor being more like the president of American university and having a lot of outside activities and representing the university. And it does seem to me there is a scope here for an academic link between the top university decision-making processes. Somebody who is the academic link, as the Secretary General was, and what's going on in departments and faculties. And I'm sure the registrar has got a full-time job looking after all the administrative aspects of the university. I don't know. I mean, I'm not that involved now enough to know whether that's a reasonable criticism or not, but I'm personally a bit sad to see that aspect of the job apparently having disappeared.
Can you, I mean, it may be too complicated, but can you explain the kind of structure, certainly at that time, of how the university administration worked? The Regent House was and is the kind of final governing body.
Yeah.
Below that, alongside that, the Vice-Chancellor chaired the General Board? Or?
The Vice-Chancellor chaired the General Board and chaired also the University Council, the Council of the Senate, which is, in fact, between the Regent House and the General Board.
Mm-hmm.
The General Board has got a lot of delegated power, but everything is referred up to the Council in the formal sense. The formal structure is reported to the Council, and I'm sure it still does. And the Regent House is the supreme governing body. I can't remember the exact details of what everybody is.
Yep.
Who's entitled to be a member of the Regent House, but it's all
resident MAs,
lecturers and many college fellows and so on.
Yep.
And then the arrangement, and I think it's still next term, is that the council approves a grace, which is a proposal to do this or that or the other, and that if no responses from members of the Regent House in sufficient scale, it automatically is graced within a certain time. But I've forgotten now the exact numbers of members of the Regent House could call for a ballot, and then it has to go to a ballot of all members of the Regent House. The voting for which was usually pretty small. Out of a total of 3,000 or whatever members of the Regent House, the voting would often be 124-76. So it's a problem about what is a representative group of members of Regent House that can hold this thing. Now, okay, I was involved in trying to effect certain changes or proposals that the General Board had approved, and sometimes there's a danger that they would fall foul of a relatively small number of people who the job, vast majority of members of Regent House just want to get on and do their research and do their teaching and pursue their subjects.
What did you think were the strengths and weaknesses of a system like this as a way of governing a university?
Perhaps the strengths are clearly the sense of involvement, which is unique to Cambridge and no doubt Oxford, the similar system.
Different from Leicester?
Different from Leicester.
Mm.
In fact, Leicester was had the standard governance arrangements for the universities that have been created by statute from about 1890 onwards to, in Leicester's case, to 1950, which had a council, which is the formal governing body, which consisted of perhaps about 40 members, whom slightly more than half would be non-members of the university, chaired by one of those non-members, which, with the Vice Chancellor, if you like, is, that's like a board with the chairman of the board and the Vice Chancellor, if you like, chief executive. And then there was an academic senate, which would be quite large, in Leicester's case about 130, all full professors and various other people designated by office would be members of the academic senate, which dealt with academic matters, and that was chaired by the Vice Chancellor. I think it worked quite well, but there is a considerable responsibility on Vice Chancellor in those circumstances to try and ensure that there is a good spread of information and opinions are encouraged and dealt with through a system of subcommittees and indeed informally. Mm. It meant that decisions could be made more quickly. And I was quite grateful for that because there's no doubt that a university like Leicester in competing with Oxford or Cambridge is not going to get not going to get facilities provided by research councils as readily, and the ability to make quick decisions is certainly an advantage. For example, there was the Medical Research Council during my time at Leicester decided they would like to set up a unit of toxicology attached to the university, and Cambridge was one, and Leicester was another. I think we had a very good case, and I'm not sure, I think the case probably stood up anyway, but certainly the fact that we could make a fairly quick decision to accept it and to agree the arrangements for it to be set up was an advantage.
When you said the advantages were representation, the disadvantages slowness?
Yes.
Hmm. Any other disadvantages? Or?
I sometimes think that here there is a possible for a fairly small group of unrepresentative people who decide that what they really want to do in life is to have a say in the running of the university. They don't represent anyone in particular except themselves.
Mm.
And the regular providers of fly sheets on proposals.
Mm.
Were around in my time. They're probably still there.
You must have read at some point Cornford's Microcosmographia Academica. Do you think that's a good representation of what?
To some extent, it's a caricature, but it's a very there's a lot of truth there, and the principles of the unrightness of time and the wage and so on, and the good reasons for not doing anything. But I used to reread that every summer when I was at Leicester, along with Machiavelli's The Prince, as some guides to how to deal with my job.
Mm.
Academics, of course, love the debate. Mm. They don't necessarily like making decisions. In fact, I can vividly recall in a debate in St. John's governing body about whether we should admit women, which I was in favour of and proposing, one of my colleagues, who I hoped I'd persuaded to vote in favour of the change, got up in the debate and spoke against it. And so afterwards I said, "Hugh, what on earth was that about?" He said, "What you don't realise, dear boy, is that we love the debate. If ever we made a decision on this issue, we wouldn't be able to debate it anymore." I think the debate is such that sometimes it's difficult to make a decision. Now that's a side effect which one just has to live with.
Mm.
I think there's some vice chancellors who found that aspect of life to be intolerable.
Mm.
I regarded it as a as an irritation, but a challenge.
Hmm. Did the fact that Cambridge is a collegiate university and for three or four centuries was run by the heads of colleges rather than by anyone else, did that, in what ways did that impinge on your job? I mean,
as Secretary General?
Hmm.
Not a great deal. There was quite heavy weighting, of course, in the council structure, the composition of the council, the Senate, filled with representatives of the heads of houses. But I found them actually really pretty constructive, and I got to know many of them quite well, and found they're very useful people to have conversations with about what's going on in the university, what could be done about the university, what their ideas were. And I found them extremely supportive on that.
Were there any heads of house who you got to know particularly well? I mean, Harry Hinsley was presumably master at St John's.
Harry I knew, of course, very well.
Mm.
I can remember some of them were, of course, on the boards that I got to know. I remember, and I just brought to mind recently because he just died, Derek Brewer at Emmanuel, who was an extremely good fellow to talk to. I found that on the whole pretty positive.
And Gabriel Horne did you get to?
Gabriel wasn't head of house at the time, but I didn't know him by the head of zoology. He is a great
mover and shaker. He
is. Yeah. There were people who were, and it's very important this job to sort of identify the movers and shakers, and the people who were likely to influence opinion.
Mm.
And Gabriel one, and Jack Lewis was another who was actually on the general board, and great source of good advice to me and wisdom. And certainly when I went to Leicester, one of the first things I had to try and work out is who are the people who are established in the university and regarded as framers of opinion.
Mm.
And try and get to know them and hopefully get them to hopefully trust me and respect me and certainly work with me and take note of what their views were. That was an interesting challenge. So, in summary, about this kind of job of being Secretary General and Vice Chancellor, it's the challenge of providing leadership, and every now and then to say, we've got to make a decision on this, and my view is such and such.
Mm.
I think we've had a long debate. But actually also trying to get people to the position where they feel they've had their say, and do recognise that in the end, somebody has to say, we're going to do this rather than that. How successfully I did it, and other people can tell.
Cornford talks about squaring, as we know famously. In
yes.
Did you have to do that? Not that kind of squaring of, that he talks about, but a lot of sort of behind the scenes, getting people on board, as they say in the cliche.
Yeah. Yes, indeed. Indeed. I'm not sure squaring is part of the right phrase.
No.
Most of it wasn't as nicely rectilinear as that suggests. It involved lots of bends, isn't it?
And you, with the vice-chancellors you worked with, you mentioned the first one. Did you work with Peter Swinnerton now, or was that in another context?
Peter, by the time I became vice-chancellor, was chairman of the University Grants Committee. And I had dealings with him over there at Leicester. But one thing I remember, I inherited the Faculty of Humanities, which was in some disarray. It wasn't my predecessor's fault, it's just that. Not a very big faculty, probably about 80 to 90 full-time academic staff, maybe 1,000 students, 13 different departments. So that some of the departments were tiny, two or three people. The funding, or the grants committee as it then was having a series of subjects, national subject reviews. One of the big ones that he did writing was Earth Sciences, looking at the general provision that is it necessary to have as many departments of Earth Sciences, or should we try and consolidate them to give them a smaller number of stronger, more viable departments. And they came to the conclusion that it should, and Leicester in fact was a beneficiary in terms of Earth Sciences. But they were also having reviews of classics, which we had a department of three people, investment and music in Parliament, 2.5 people. And I suspected that the answer was going to be that we should close. So I went to see Peter, whom I knew anyway. And I said, look, Peter, I gather you're having these reviews. I know you're having these reviews. I guess the answer is going to be that you would recommend to Leicester that we should close both those departments. He said, well, I can't possibly anticipate the outcome, but you might not be very surprised at the answer. And so what I suggested is that under the deal, I would close the department if it allowed me to keep the money and put it into archaeology in one case, history and English, which were good departments, but would benefit from being a bit bigger. A fairly small number of students involved, and obviously could see their students through their courses. And we did, that was the arrangement worked out. Now, I think that probably part of Peter's strength and force of personality was allowed you to get an agreement with him and stick. And he was, in some senses, insulated from the kind of pressures that the funding council has now. But we did that. During the time that I've been, a period of what was it? I retired in 1999 from Leicester. I'd been there 12 years, 3 years before that, second down. The system's changed to really out of recognition. I saw many people have been through this would say during their time when it happened, but when I accepted the job at Leicester, there was still discussions in government circles about the effect of the demographic decline in the number of 18-year-olds predicted over the next 20 years. And there was talk about it actually closing some universities because the number of 18-year-olds were going to drop by 30%. And I remember thinking, well, am I wise to leave Cambridge, which is clearly not going to close, and go somewhere where it might close? And then I realised that Leicester had, apart from its intrinsic merits, had two political advantages. One was that the three parliamentary seats in the city of Leicester were all highly marginal. And the second was it had a medical school. So I was pretty confident it wouldn't be closed. But of course, what happened in practice was that the uptake rate amongst 18-year-olds rose so rapidly it overwhelmed this small decline in the number of 18-year-olds. That's one change. So we've got massification, and now we're talking about something approaching 50% in higher education. Then it was 15%. Second, and this is in a way a more pervasive change, was the consequence of the change in the sort of industrial basis of this country and many others from being making things in large numbers to sell to the rest of the world, having to have living in a information age or whatever you like to call it, digital phase, knowledge society, with government thinking we've got to live by our wits, we can't just make lots of things and sell them cheaply. Population. That will happen somewhere else in the world, but not here. Governments therefore become seeing higher education as being an essential part of economic development, which is good in one sense and that we recognise, but the danger is that they actually want to determine very closely what kind of higher education system it should be. So the combination of these two things meant expansion without matching funding. Same sort of level that had been, and that was inevitable. And there is, in fact, a case to be made for students making some kind of financial contribution. When I for 2 years of my time at Leicester, I was chairman of the National Committee of Vice Chancellors, CVCP, and we anticipated something like this would come, the fees would be introduced. And so we did commissioned some research. Look at the financial benefits of individuals who are having a degree compared to people who've got, say, the two A levels or the equivalent, something that would have got them into university but decided not to go to university. And the financial advantages were quite considerable, even after tax, of having a university degree. So there clearly is a substantial private benefit about university education, from rising from university education, as well as it being public good. And so So some contribution, the argument that some contribution is to be expected. So there's that sort of squeeze on money. At the same time, a greater sense of direction about what university should be doing. And again, and then you've got social engineering coming in and postcode benefits if you take students from certain postcodes and so on. And at a higher level of accountability. And this is actually shown in the way that the Funding Council operates, as well as the many, many government initiatives. And like many aspects of public service, publicly funded services, which we are, there's a high level of target setting, of accountability, which is diverting effort on a huge scale from what the university should be doing. And so there's a dilemma of having the opportunity to do more and make a bigger contribution to society, while at the same time being swamped in a blanket of demand for accountability. And that change happened during my time. But I still feel that while there are quite legitimate complaints from many people in universities about the amount of time they have to spend in a whole range of administrative tasks, many of which are having to account for what they've done, and which are beneficial. I mean, I think the research assessment exercise, when it started, was for the university system in general, had beneficial effects. It made every university think, what are we actually doing to support research? Are we doing it in the most effective way? Or are we just sort of letting the thing drift? And so there's better university management of research, and I don't mean that in a negative sense. I mean, you're actually trying to decide where are really good things going and can we fund them and support them. But it developed a life of its own and became sort of incredibly intrusive with very little effect. So I think the problem about this is that the bright ideas become should have a short life, a short time span, because they have a stimulus effect and then they don't need them. They go on with a life of their own and become overly intrusive. So I think I probably retired at the right time.
When you came back after 12 years in Leicester, did you find, you've presumably been living there and your wife was there.
Yeah.
Did you find Cambridge greatly changed, either the general sort of externals of the city and the environment and or the atmosphere of the university as you re-encountered it?
I don't, yes, well, of course I have said the latter. I don't have that sort of detailed involvement, day-to-day involvement. I was aware of the changes that happened. I was aware of the changes that happened in the way it's administered. And I said, I think essentially it should be changed towards a full-time permanent vice chancellor. The city, of course, has changed in the time since the time I came here, as full recognition. In some ways, I feel quite proud of the place. That, you know, there's a university that's actually still at the level of economic activity, directly and indirectly, which is something that I think university ought to do. And it's not lost its soul in the process, it seems to me, at all. So I think I've had the side effects of this, of course, are much more crowds, many more crowds, a larger city, traffic gridlock. But I don't think, I don't get the impression that the university at its departmental level has changed very much, except there's weight of demands for accountability, which is affecting everybody.
And there's a new tier of the university, which wasn't it, has grown over the years, which is the middle level of the councils of the schools, which is more similar to what you'd have in Leicester and so on, which between the faculty boards and the general board and so on, which is getting ever more powerful. That's the change I noticed from below.
Yes, I can see that. In fact, I think that's a trend in most universities. I mean, what happened involving Leicester, I encouraged it, was to give the faculties, because we had quite large faculties, in the sense of covering a range of subjects other than essentially faculties of medicine, of natural science, of engineering, of law, humanities, social sciences, making each of those much more responsible for its own affairs. So in a sense they were like the councils, and the scale of the whole thing is much smaller, and the heads of those working with me and the Pro Vice Chancellors formed a sort of senior management team and tried to sort of get strategies developed that would seem sensible. And giving those heads of those faculties, the heads of the schools, if you like, a greater degree of autonomy about how they use their resources. We obviously couldn't start paying people whatever they felt like, but you know, about where, when vacancies occur, where they have the money, where to create a new job. On the arguments that they were no better than any university committee, where the real pressures and opportunities were. Disadvantage is that you do lose some contact with department and the Senate. Senate was too big in one sense. February turned out to be 130 people. Very rarely did many of the professors of medicine turn up. The dean turned up and spoke for them all. And he was in number. And it was too big to be really effective decision making without a constancy of membership. We did lots of different people at different times. But it was still a very, very valuable opportunity, a kind of forum for debate and a way of spreading information.
Let's just finally come back to you as a person. Two subjects I always like to touch on, and we touch on one slightly, and that is politics. I mean, you sketched in that on the whole you were a Democrat and you were slightly left of your father. Would you have voted Labour most of your life, or?
I voted at different times. I voted for different parties in different elections. And to some extent I like to think that I'm voting for the individual candidate. So that when David Lane was a member here, he was Conservative in Cambridge, I voted for him because I knew him and felt him, and I respected him. I thought it was a degree of clarity of thought, of sensitivity and independence of thought, and I think a good thing to have in Parliament.
Did you know my uncle, who was Robert Rhodes James?
Yes, I did.
My mother's brother.
I didn't know, did I?
And he must have been around about the time.
Yes, he was, yes.
Did you get on with Robert?
I didn't know him very well, no. But interesting figure.
So you, at that time you felt some sympathy with David Lane, but at other times...
I voted, I mean, in 97 I voted Labour. And I had to bet that all the people who thought that Tony Blair was going to be one of the great Prime Ministers ever. We all make mistakes. I don't know this time. I don't think any of the political parties have much clue about what's going on at the moment. Economically, they think they're all floating back in the dark. I don't think there's actually a huge difference on social matters between social issues between the leaderships of the major parties. They're all fighting for the centre ground. And so feeling that sometimes it's a good thing to give the other lot an opportunity. I'm just going to watch fresh faces and come into the attire. So I'm not sure which way I'll go next time.
And the other subject which we haven't touched on at all is religion. I've discovered in my interviews that on the whole the biological sciences are more hostile to religion than the physicists and the astronomers, who have a sense that maybe there's something mysterious out there. How would you characterise your own religion?
I don't have a belief. I would hesitate to say I'm an atheist, but that actually sounds too positive and puts me in the Richard Dawkins camp. And my reasoning is that I don't see in everything we know about the universe any, and the way it operates from all aspects of science, any need to invoke anybody who changes things from time to time. In other words, once the rules are set up, as they seem to have been operating for the last 13.7 billion years, plus or minus a few seconds. and as a biologist, I think one of the, you know, lived through Darwinism, the DNA revolution and so on, and it is now so clear to me that, evolution with natural selection and all that is a perfectly adequate explanation of the diversity of living forms we've got. They clearly all share the same kind of information systems, they clearly have the same kind of metabolic systems. So I don't see any need to invoke a god who's active at present. Nor have I had any kind of direct personal experience which I would say was religious. That may be reflection on me rather than anything else, that my mind is shut against it. I don't know. How it was all set up, what created it in the first place, whether parallel universities, I don't know. But I mean, summarising, I'm not a believer.
Mm. And you never have been, really?
Yes, in my childhood I used to go to church. My parents were... My parents actually came from different denominations. My mother was a Methodist, my father was C of E. And I say C of E deliberately because that was the kind of thing to do, you know, to be an Anglican. They couldn't agree on where to go to church, so they didn't go very often, but they insisted that I was confirmed and was an active believer for the time. So sort of gradually came to my present views, I suppose, when I was mid-20s. But I may be wrong.
That's a good scientific thing, the suspended judgment. Is there anything that you would like to have been asked or comment on? You mentioned Janet, your wife, and you've mentioned your children. Is there anything else that part of your life that we've missed?
I don't think so, except to I feel I'm extremely fortunate in life. There was a time when healthcare improved, so I've managed to live to be 70-something in reasonably good health. I had an opportunity to go through an education, do the kind of jobs. And the kind of jobs I've been doing, I've enjoyed them all and at every level. I made a jump from one kind of activity to another, but not sort of different kind of activity, but not in a totally different world. I'm glad I made that change because I've enjoyed what I've been doing since. And I've been very fortunate. So I think maybe there's some golden age to live through, but perhaps that's a sign about getting into your 70s of looking back and thinking, yeah, this was a golden age. And it's gone quite well for me. Maybe, I don't know, thinking of my own grandchildren, will the world be as easy for them? Too young to have to get involved in any major world wars. And what will it be like in the future? I don't know. But that's perhaps the other side of growing old. I think the future's probably going to be pretty miserable. I think about, you know, what's the economy going to be like? What's the environment going to be like? What's the climate going to be like?
Who knows? When we watch this in a few years' time, we'll
yeah.
A bit of a more of an answer. But thank you very much indeed for a very interesting interview.